You're listening to WCOM LP 103.5 FM Carborough and Chapel Hill. It's a Tuesday, it's 5 o'clock, and that only means one thing. It's time for another round of Snarky Faith with your host, Stuart Deloney. This is a space where we irreverently wrestle through life, culture, and spirituality, all with our heads in the clouds, our tongues in our cheeks, our hearts in our sleeves, and our feet on the ground. At Snarky Faith, the questions or even the answers are never the point. It's all about the conversation. So here's your host, Stuart Deloney.
Well, good afternoon and welcome to another round of Snarky Faith Radio. I'm your host, Stuart Deloney. I'm so excited to be here today. But guess what, guys? You're going to have to buckle up. We've got no time in this show. No time for intros, no time for chit-chat, Christian crazy in the news, none of that this week. I'm sitting down in an interview. Well, we're going to have an interesting interview about Liberty University. Yes. We talk about it all the time on the show. So, you know, it's going to be a fun one, and it ain't going to be positive. So, you know what? Buckle up, because here we go, starting right now. Lucas Wilson is a former student from Liberty University. He's also got an MA from McMaster's, and MTS from Vanderbilt. He's currently a PhD candidate in comparative studies at Florida Atlantic University, and he's also an adjunct professor. But going back to that thing about being a former student at Liberty, Lucas is also one of 33 plaintiffs that is suing the U.S. Department of Education in a class action lawsuit that centers on the questions of whether or not religious colleges and universities, especially evangelical ones, should receive federal funds while actively discriminating against their LGBTQ+ students. So welcome, Lucas. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
So, Lucas, you attended Liberty a while back. So this is, you were like 2008 to 2012?
Guilty as charged, yes.
So it's been years since this has happened. So what led you to step in and be part of this class action lawsuit?
Yeah, so the class action lawsuit actually, as of recent, has changed. It's not, there are now 40 of us who are plaintiffs. I am one of them, obviously. As for the class action lawsuit, what brought me to it was, at first, Facebook. Someone on Facebook, I'm in a bunch of these ex-evangelical and deconstruction Facebook groups. And one of them, there was this guy, he came on and he said, "Hey, does anyone know anyone who was discriminated against while attending an evangelical university or college for their sexual orientation or gender identity or expression?" And someone tagged me and said, "You know, Luke Wilson, like, you're the guy who talks about this." And I replied, and this guy turned out to be a lawyer. His name is Paul Southwick. He's the one who's leading the lawsuit. He's the director of the Religious Exemption Accountability Project. It's called REAP. This organization, what they're doing is, like you said, we're suing the U.S. Department of Education, saying, "Hey, if you want to discriminate against queer students, you can do that. We're not saying you should do that, but you can. Just do it on your own dime and not on the taxpayer's dime." And so it was started off with Facebook. Paul, again, just a phenomenal human being. He also went through conversion therapy. He went through conversion therapy at George Fox University in Oregon. And he is leading the charge. And we're looking for a big W here. We're looking for a win.
Now, talking about someone that was, well, I mean, let's start in the beginning with you. Because I want to even get behind what leads a kid to go to Liberty University, a special one that is struggling with their sexuality. What was your, like, at that time, like, what does childhood look like for you? Like, what was your church background? What was your indoctrination that you were raised under?
The crazy thing is that I wasn't actually raised in a Christian home. My mom, when we were little, up until about grade two, would take us on and off to church. She was haunted by, like, her Baptist demons, still is, but we certainly weren't a Christian family. You know, by the time I was in church, and which was grade nine onwards, which is when I became a Christian, my family was not considered by the church families a Christian family. Like, I wasn't, you know, going home and talking about God. I wasn't praying with my parents or anything like that. My dad was agnostic. My mom, again, tortured by her religious upbringing. And as a result, we weren't a religious family. I'm the youngest of five. And I was the only one who was going to church at that point. I was the only one, I suppose, who at that point was interested in questions of faith or religion. But I chose Christianity for myself. It was actually through the creation versus evolution debate. I got roped into that. And by grade nines, the commencement of grade nine, I decided that, you know, if I believe that there's a creator, I should go figure out who this creator is. And the answer that seemed most reasonable to my grade nine mind was, oh, it must be the God that of the church that I went to growing up. And so, you know, not too much critical reflection, though, of course, evangelicals aren't necessarily known or defined by critical reflection. And I guess I was, you know, I fit in quite well in that sense. And for 4 years, I was at the church that I went to. It was a Fellowship Evangelical Baptist Church, which is a Canadian, well, it's actually, I believe, North American, but it's a pretty conservative Baptist tradition. And that, of course, I eventually went to Liberty, which is a Southern Baptist school. And so the progression was quite natural in that sense. But I actually found out about Liberty because my mom's cousin was the national recruiter for Liberty in Canada. And so he said to me one time, he was like, "Hey, Luke, do you want to come down for a trip to Virginia?" And I was like, "Not really." You know, like, who wants to go to Virginia? And so he's like, no, come down. It's a free trip. You'll have fun. So I said, all right, if it's a free trip, might as well. And so off I went and going down and actually checking Liberty out. I remember thinking to myself, you know, like, oh my goodness, like, this place is crazy. It's so cool. Cause in Canada, you know, college or university, it's like not that big of a deal. It's not that, you know, all that to say is that America, they do things bigger. And so college or university experience is just a wee bit different. And so when I was there, I was like, my goodness, like, how much fun would it be to be, you know, in a place with thousands of other Christians my age? And that at the time was quite alluring. And so I eventually got a scholarship to go. Though, like I say now, in order to have a scholarship, you must be doing scholarship. And the work that I did at Liberty University, I don't know if I can define as scholarship, but by gosh, I was there for 4 years and the rest is history.
Now, okay. So you got to unpack that at least a little bit, this idea of what scholarship is like there. Cause this has been like one of my morbid fascinations with Liberty. I had a friend that went back to school because Liberty also collects a lot of people that started college but didn't finish. And they collect you through, hey, we'll help you finish this, you know, for just sign on the dotted line. And it was a friend of mine that I was like, oh, don't do it. Don't go there. Don't do this. But then he became the person where I'd ask him, oh, you're taking a class on creationism. Tell me, how does Liberty describe this? You know, and he would tell me these crazy things to where it's like, oh, when the Lord created it, he created the earth already old. Like, he created the trees already this old. And I was like, oh, really? That's some awesome mental gymnastics that you're going through here to explain stuff. So yes, tell us, this is like, and he's the person I've had to pull it out of over time. So I have a feeling I'm not going to have to pull that out of you. So give us a flavor for the like air quote scholarship.
Yeah. Well, I love that. I love even that, the idea that like God created the earth already old or the trees already old. It's like, yeah, that's what the Bible says, doesn't it? Nope. Like, where are you getting this from? Like, enough. But I digress. Yeah. No, the quality of education I received at Liberty was like wildly disappointing. I'll fast forward for a second, then I'll rewind. When I got to grad school, I eventually went to McMaster, school here in Ontario, in Hamilton, Ontario. And when I got there, I was so underprepared and had no clue what was being talked about in my classes that by the time when I was writing my thesis prospectus or proposal, you know, normally when someone's writing that, they'll be passed on the first round or maybe the second round if they have like a little bit of, you know, some revisions to do. I wasn't rejected for my proposal once, twice, three times, not four, not five, not six, not seven, but on the eighth time is when it was finally accepted. That is sincerely unheard of. And I remember one time a professor at Liberty, I got into it with her on Facebook. This is of course after I had left, and she said like, oh, you know, well, all students, when they go to grad school, it's a level up. And I was like, yeah, that's obviously true. Like by the time I got to from my master's to my PhD there, it's a level up, but it's not the level up that I experienced. And I explained and I gave her like, you know, I was rejected. Only on my eighth time was I accepted for my proposal. And she was like, oh, wow. Yeah, that really is bad. And it's like, yeah. And you're the people who trained me. And so, or pardon me, should I say did not train me well. So, I mean, the thing is like, for instance, when I was at Liberty, the first class I ever stepped foot into was my American government class. And in that class, for example, we learned the 10 reasons why the Bible supports capitalism. I wish to God that I still had my notebook, but actually I was known for taking good notes. Gosh. And so I lent my notebook to someone who lost it. But that's one of the examples of the 10, you know, reasons why, or the 10 reasons, or there are 10 reasons, according to this professor, why the Bible supports capitalism. The creation, the idea that God created the world 10 to 15,000 years ago was certainly something that was peddled. Let's think, like, I now teach, like, I teach writing in literature and communications, and I've looked over my papers from the time I was there, and honestly, if I were to grade the papers that I submitted now, and I'm not, I think I'm pretty fair. I wouldn't have passed the vast majority of those papers. I study English and literary studies. Of course, you're analyzing. You're not just regurgitating the plot and saying, "Oh, this was a good story. This was a fun story." Like that's, but that those were how my papers read. Like this was a story about this, and it's like, yep, there's some plot description. So where's the analysis? And this was all passed. I graduated summa cum laude from Liberty, aka like highest honors, which is just an absolute joke. And I don't mean that because it's not a bragging moment, because there's nothing to brag about. It's like I just somehow, you know, by doing the bare minimum, and I wouldn't even say I was trying to do the bare minimum, but looking back, like handing in a paper somehow got you a grade. It was honestly such I struggled to think about what I really learned there, other than, you know, a thorough education in American conservatism, both politically and religiously.
That's a really good point, because I think for those that may not know this that well, like Liberty was founded in 1971 by Southern Baptist televangelist Jerry Falwell. I want to get into some of the culture there too, because I know there's the Liberty Way, which is their honor code, which part of their honor code states that sexual relations outside of a biblically ordained marriage between a natural born man and a natural born woman are not permissible at Liberty University. So for you as a student who's going in, wanting to learn more about God, wanting to like, you have like this fervor, this desire to do this. When did the wheels start coming off? Like, when did you start noticing stuff was like, hold on a second, this isn't what I thought it was going
to
be.
That was more so an after-the-fact moment that I started to both deconstruct, but also critically reflect on Liberty and my time there. My sister came down. My sister, she also was doing her PhD. She's maybe the smart one, and she dropped out because she got a job, and I'm still in here, and I don't have a job, like a permanent job, so maybe she really is the smart one. But she came down to visit me, and I wanted to impress her. I wanted her to come into one of my classes and show her what we learned at Liberty and be like, look how good this education is here. And so she came down, she came to one of my classes. We went to literary criticism. And literary criticism in Canada is oftentimes like you learn that throughout, or like just like criticism or like social theories or whatever. You learn that like throughout your entire education. It's not like a fourth year seminar or not. It's not like a fourth year, you know, class. So Kaylee, after the class, I said to her, I was like, you know, hey, Kaylee, what'd you think about the class? And she's like, wait, that's like a fourth year course or a senior level course. And I said, yeah. And she goes, Luke, Marxism, like you're learning about Marxism? I said, yeah. She goes, we learned that in our first year, like social theory course in sociology. She's like, what do you mean this is a fourth year course? And I remember being like, how dare you like talk about my education that way? And so that was the first moment where it was like, okay, this isn't, again, a great education. Then of course the question is like, was it not, it wasn't just this, you know, the education aspect, but it was also just like an institution. And I also remember another one of my siblings, again, my siblings really put me on my place a lot of the time. My brother Zach, he said to me one time, this was over a summer vacation. He called me downstairs and he's like, Luke, watch this video with me. It was of course of Jerry Falwell Sr. And he says about terrorists, he says, to blow them away in the name of the Lord is the phrase that he uses. And my brother looks at me and he says, how the hell do you believe, you know, or how the hell do you like go to this man's school and think that like that's okay? And again, that for me was this moment where I was like, maybe it's like, maybe this guy is a little bit wacky. Because the thing was that the good news was that I never had bought into the American political ideology that Liberty had pushed. It was only the religious stuff. The political stuff, I mean, I'm Canadian and like, we're not nearly as conservative in a lot of ways. And my dad certainly wasn't conservative. And I always thought of him as like a super smart guy. So I thought to myself, well, I don't need to, politics and religion were separate to me in a lot of ways. So the political stuff I always thought was pretty crazy. And Liberty has what's called Constitution Week. And that was always the most annoying thing for us international students and Canadian students, of course, internationals. because they would have this week where they would talk about like how amazing the US is, and they would be all about, you know, pumping America's tires in the name of American exceptionalism and talking about how the Constitution is like the second greatest piece of literature and, or, you know, writing in Earth's history, of course, the Bible being number one, and going on and on and on. And I remember being like, what the hell is this? Like, this is absolute tomfoolery. And they even had this one speaker. Mm-hmm. He was this former like governor of Ohio, I think. And he starts going on about like an America this and America this. And he started talking about how America invented the telephone. And of course, if you're a Canadian kid, you know that's not true, because Alexander Graham Bell, who was Scottish, invented the telephone in Canada, in Brantford, Ontario. So like you know this, like you learned this. And so afterwards, I went up to the speaker, being a little loudmouth that I am, and I said, hey, sir, just so you know, Americans didn't invent the telephone, nor did you actually invent aviation. That was done in Australia, I believe, a few weeks earlier before the Wright brothers, but you know, neither here nor there. I said, but let's go back to the telephone. And he's like, yeah, you know, inventions, they're a crazy thing. And you're like, I was just standing there like, wait, what the hell does that mean? But all this to say is there were moments and there were like windows into how crazy liberty was that were revealed to me throughout my time there. But it wasn't, but by and large, I was drinking the Kool-Aid. Like I was on board. I wasn't really pushing against liberty in many ways other than the political stuff. Education, certainly I thought that my education was great until I got to grad school. And I had a quick realization that my education was so incredibly poor. And then on top of that, realizing that liberty itself is this crazy religious institution. And of course, that coincided with my religious deconstruction, which was happening, I suppose, both at McMaster, at Vanderbilt, well, and then on top of that, at FAU. And so, and maybe up until today, arguably. And so I think that the shenanigans of Jerry Falwell Jr. certainly didn't help. And when he invited Trump, I remember I was like, not tweet, or what do you do on Facebook? You like updates, right? You're not live tweeting, but like live updates, or whatever. Yeah. And Trump had come to speak at commencement. This was Trump's second time at Liberty, or maybe it was his third time, if I'm not mistaken, but it was his second honorary doctorate that he received, which has still not been rescinded. They still have that. Most other schools have rescinded their, taken back their offers for an honorary doctorate, but Liberty is holding fast and whatever. So I was like live tweeting, not tweeting, whatever, updating on my Facebook. And I had a professor there who was like really upset with me because she was taking it personally that I was talking poorly of Liberty. And she eventually blocked me. We're now like on decent terms. We're on Twitter now, but we're still not friends on Facebook. You know, that's something I'll have to rectify later. But I was going on about, again, like how wild of an institution Liberty is. And again, like how the world just does not respect Liberty for like a multitude of reasons. But again, that was at a time when I was really breaking down how poor my education was. And I was, you know, of course, responding to it in part through these messages or through these updates on Facebook. After that, it just kind of turned into this thing on Facebook where I just kept posting about it. And people were like, you're the Liberty guy now. And that turned into like who I've become. And I never wanted that. Like that was never... It's never who I wanted to be, what I wanted to be known for, but here we are.
Now within your experiences, before you, well, I guess let's talk about like back to the height of your Kool-Aid drinking. We'll go back to that play. And you had experiences at Liberty, which many others have gone through similar things of going through conversion therapy. And I know I've had like lots of like listeners and people talking about Pray Away, like the conversion therapy documentary on Netflix. I've watched it. It's good. I wish they went further in it too. And I thought they were a little too even-handed, but that's besides the point. So I want to tell you, like, I want to see, so how did that even come about? You know, I mean, so you're a student there. Like how do we go from like, I'm a student at Liberty. Now I'm in conversion therapy. Like that's, you know, that's quite a leap between those two. So yeah, talk through some of this. And I know a lot of this is hard. So I just, yeah. Share what you feel comfortable sharing too.
So I actually knew about Liberty's conversion therapy program before attending, and I attended Liberty in large part because I wanted to go to this conversion therapy program because I sincerely believed that I could become straight. And people oftentimes ask, like, do you really believe you could become straight? It's like, yeah, why the heck else would I have gone to this? Like, obviously I wanted to become straight or thought it was possible. And, you know, of course, looking back now, I was made to believe that I wanted that. And nowadays I would absolutely, obviously not go to that, nor would I be straight if I could be straight, because that's not within my, you know, realm of possibilities. And I haven't really thought about, or at this point, again, like it'd be a totally different experience and lived reality for me to be straight anyway. But people oftentimes ask that. So I normally address it, even though I do think it's kind of an obvious answer to a question. But so I knew about the conversion therapy program. So I went down, and my big plan when going to Liberty was that I was going to become straight at the end. I was going to first, you know, go and have my fun with Christian guys, because I had thought at the time in high school that, you know, I was very much of the mindset that I didn't want to be a bad witness for Christ. And of course, if I were out there dating boys, well, surely no one would want to know Jesus, because I would be a poor reflection of Jesus. So I never dated anyone in high school for that reason. But when I got to Liberty, I thought, well, they're all Christians. So what are they going to do? Tell on me, or like, you know, like tell me, like tell their non-Christian friends? Probably not. They're all, you know, just as, you know, ashamed of who they are as I am. And so it's kind of the glue that I thought would bind us all together. And it certainly did in some sense. I was about 2 weeks into school. Liberty at the time, the sort of a student, what do you call it? The student leadership model at Liberty was that every dormitory had, and every dormitory was of course single sex. And I was of course on a men's dorm, and we had two RAs, so two resident advisors who were like the heads of the hall, both like in regards to authority as well as like spiritual authority, and also being able to like fine us if we did things that were against the Liberty way, the student code of conduct. Under them, they had spiritual life directors. So they were, again, like doing a lot of spiritual stuff, I suppose, and praying for people. And under them, there were prayer leaders who, of course, were praying for the rest of us plebeians. So the spiritual life, one of my spiritual life directors, he made a really looking back, he made an advance, and I accepted. And, you know, with this weird romantic encounter that turned out very poorly, because afterwards he would not talk to me. And I texted him that night after, you know, the weirdness that occurred. And I said, hey, we should probably talk. And he said, no, there's nothing to talk about. And so in my like 18-year-old mind, where I was, you know, this is all new to me, I was broken. I was like so upset. I'm ready to go and cry in the parking lot, this far parking lot, because I was so distraught that he wouldn't talk to me. And so I didn't really know what to do. And of course, I wasn't like, no one back home knew that I was gay. So I wasn't calling any of my friends back home, nor was I about to tell anyone on campus that I was gay. Or at least I didn't plan to, because that's, you know, not going to be a good look while new at Liberty. So I held the secret for a bit. Eventually I had a friend who I did tell, because what happened was I used to be able to have friends come over to my work. And so I worked at the switchboard, and, you know, anyone who called Liberty, it was me. So I just waited for phone calls, and every Sunday that I worked, no one was really calling. So I just had my friends over, and we'd just do work and whatever. So one time Michael, my friend, he came over, and he said, and we were talking, and he knew that something was wrong. He knew that there was an issue. And I said to him, I said, I don't want to tell you what's wrong, but I did write a poem about it. Would you like to listen to my poem? And he's like, sure. So the poem was titled, you ever notice how cold it gets in the fall? Like just a horribly like angsty, like my 18-year-old poem, or poem written by an 18-year-old. And so read the poem, Michael guessed it. He knew, he's like, I think I know what this poem's about. I was like, oh shoot, that wasn't the point. I didn't actually want you to know. And I had no idea he was gay. But within a few minutes, he said, like, well, I think that I struggle with the same thing. And we had this awkward fumbling back and forth. And eventually both like, we struggle with same-sex attraction. We struggle with same-sex attraction. And so he knew, but, you know, other than Michael, no one knew. So I knew that I wasn't about to like load all this onto Michael and make him like my main or sole interlocutor. So I decided that I was going to fast track my plan about dating Christian boys. And obviously that didn't work out so well. So I thought, well, I might as well get down to business and go to this conversion therapist. His name is Dane Emmerich. He just retired recently. But Dane Emmerich was the one responsible for the program, both the individual conversion therapy program, as well as the group conversion therapy program, as well as the group for men struggling with pornography addictions, which I love the idea of like a pornography addiction. Like, vast majority of these guys look at porn once a month and they're like, I'm addicted. But you know, I digress. No. And so that was the beginning of my time in conversion therapy at Liberty.
Hmm. Now, how did that, like, now you looking back at this in retrospect, going like, now you were in the midst of it. It all made sense. You trusted people in leadership. You trusted people that were supposedly there to help you. And you talk about this road about eventually kind of deconstructing this, or kind of going like back through this, going back through, oh gosh, oh, this was, oh, you know, as you kind of, you know, go through that whole memory reel of things, when you begin to look back, what, where was like, and I want to say this, I feel like systems like these are very sick. They're very sick, and they are not very kind to humans. especially when it's a system that tells you there's something wrong with you and you have to eradicate this. And especially in these scenarios, most of these, at least I'm not familiar with liberties, but I know with other ones like Exodus International and other ones like that, this really wasn't, it was based all on pseudoscience. This isn't really based on anything like, psychological or otherwise. Now you looking back, especially being years out from this and being able to look back at that young guy, that 18-year-old, that 19-year-old, what now strikes you as audacious and like, oh my gosh, I can't believe they were doing this. Or, oh, you know.
So you had actually,
what are those red flags?
You had referenced the film Pray Away and a second ago, which is, again, I think it's a good start. There are a lot of critiques that I have and a lot of survivors of conversion therapy have. But putting those aside and focusing on what was done well, which I think was exposing this institution of Exodus International. Though again, there are some blatant oversights in the film, at least according to a lot of the folks I've been in conversation with. There were two really powerful moments that drew upon my emotions, or my emotions were, you know, were disturbed in those moments, because. I didn't get emotional by watching it. It wasn't this really like hard thing for me to watch. I know for a lot of people it was. For me, it wasn't in a lot of senses because, again, it was focusing on the leadership. It wasn't focusing on survivors as much. Of course, these people are survivors in their own right, but they're also implicated in the actual power structures that allowed for Exodus to thrive and to be, you know, actually exist. But there are two moments where seeing this was a John Polk and his wife, like them holding hands, married. And I remember having to sit there with gals who holding their hands and not wanting to do it, just being like, oh my gosh, like it was just such an uncomfortable thing for me, and you know, feeling like I had to. But the other part that, again, I think more to your point, or to respond to your question, that really made me uncomfortable was when Nicolosi's that quack. Who was the one who was legitimating quote unquote conversion therapy by doing academic, or should I say quote unquote academic studies on the topic. Though of course there's literally no other research other than by Nicolosi that legitimates conversion therapy. And again, that research done by him is so poorly done and is so flawed and has been discredited by literally every single scientific and medical organization out there. But Nicolosi, there, he's included in the film, and they talk, or they show him in a room with this young man who's apparently married, who's been cheating on his wife. And the way that Nicolosi was talking to this young man, he asks him a series of questions. I actually have the quote here because I did a little interview about the film actually yesterday. In the film, he says to this young guy, who again, who's this gay guy who's married to a woman, and he says to this guy, he says, quote, "You feel broken? How does it feel to be broken sitting here in front of me? Hurtful? Very sad? Very sad to feel broken? Can you feel my acceptance over you as broken? What does it feel like? Feels good?" He's talking about his acceptance. End quote. And then the kid says, or the guy, he looks quite young, but he's, I guess, a married man. He says, "I feel like a bad person." But this whole, you know, you feel broken. How does it feel to sit here in front of me, this like manly figure, you know, being broken? Does it hurt you? Is it sad? Like this, like, these obviously very leading questions. That was something that, to be honest, until I saw that, when I actually did hear, you know, Nicolosi saying this, it just revived so much of the way that my conversion therapist talked to me that I suppose at this point had blocked out. And so seeing that, it reanimated what had happened in those rooms, and hearing these questions, these leading, guiding questions, really pushing for, hey, you should feel disgusting about yourself. Right? You're a broken person. You're not complete. You need to know what it means to be a full man, because right now you're not a complete man. You're not like aligning yourself with the capital M masculine, right? And it reminded me so much of that. And so I think that part of the film speaks to what it is to be in conversion therapy, And to see how manipulative and insidious and disgusting this practice is, that just reinscribes so much shame and guilt and anxiety and depression and self-hatred and self-abnegation, like that is what conversion therapy thrives on. And it needs that in order for these people to stay within it. Because if they don't, if they actually feel fine about themselves, well, surely they're not going to be in conversion therapy. And so that for me was, I think, a pretty, I don't know, it was a moment that got me.
It's interesting because I know watching that, it triggered within me. I've never been a person who's been through conversion therapy, but I've definitely been around many, many unhealthy situations within evangelical churches with spiritual abuse and otherwise. And I think you're very right. I feel like that there's this whole system that they thrive on of like secrecy and shame. You know, this whole thing to somehow, as long as we have you back on your heels feeling like you're not good enough, we can keep you in this place and we can keep controlling you. And we can keep you here. And it is a sick system of shame that they're acting like this idea. They're acting like they need to break you down so they can build you up. And the problem of the matter is they themselves don't even really know what they're doing to begin with. They're broken people running and hiding in shame from their own stuff. And it's just as well, as long as we can keep focusing on your shame, I don't have to talk about my shame.
But part of that too is that, like you said, like they don't even know what they're doing. And that goes in, that's in two senses. One, they're not trained professionals. Like and just like Exodus, you know, the folks in Exodus said, like not, the vast majority of these people didn't have any qualifications or credentials to actually do, you know, counseling work. But on top of that, they have no idea what they're doing or they're talking about, which is so characteristic of so many people who are quote unquote on fire for God. Look at people downtown. Like I walk by down here in Toronto, Yonge and Dundas is kind of like our version of Times Square, though infinitely smaller and less impressive. And so you go down to Yonge and Dundas and you'll have these street preachers and you'll ask them honestly basic questions about scripture, about interpretation, about, you know, the canonization of the Bible, about theology, about authorship, whatever. And they have not the slightest clue, but they're so incredibly charismatic and they're so incredibly insistent that what they're saying is truth, God's truth, whatever. And I think that is just, again, it just speaks to how within conversion therapy or outside of conversion therapy, whether it's, you know, all these different sort of programs or ways of talking about and to people and treating people within evangelical spaces, that it's a cult of personality. And I think because of that, what happens is that people have to, there's this blind, willful submission to authority, right? There are so many people who say like, well, my pastor says this. And I had the same thought, like, well, if my Liberty professor said this, it must be true. I don't need to go do that intellectual work for myself. I just trust based on their word that what they're saying is accurate. And I think that's part of the mechanism of control that you find at Liberty and elsewhere. And another part of that, like we were saying, is this circulation of affect or feelings or emotions, right? That we circulate shame, we circulate guilt, we circulate anxiety, whatever that might be. And how these are again, it's the glue that holds these spaces together, because people are feeling so bad about themselves. They're so willfully submitting to authority that, of course, it's in some ways a perfect storm, a perfect recipe for abuse, like you said, spiritual abuse.
Well, and even adding to that, which is something I loved how you brought this up earlier about the quality of education. So if they're also, if what they're perpetuating is kind of a low form of education, it's going to perpetuate a low form of like reading scripture, a low form of being able to analyze scripture and read it in a way that makes more sense. Whereas especially to a lot of the scriptures they cling to, which we would call their clobber passages, a lot of those are out of context or haven't even been translated correctly, et cetera, but... But far be it from us to question something like you're mentioning that the leadership, you know, what was it, Falwell Jr. and all of that being a cut boy, that, you know, I mean, all this crazy stuff that's happening that we even find, like I think you mentioned earlier, that those in leadership aren't even following their own honor codes. They're not even being able to follow this kind of thing, which just leads to this deep and deep hypocrisy. Now, I hope, Lucas, I hope it seems that you have survived this. It seems that you are doing well. You've made your way out of this. Now, you had mentioned, too, that deconstruction started partially educationally as you got out, started saying, like, what? What, like, where did you start being able to kind of unpack some of that conversion therapy stuff? When did you be able to start seeing yourself differently? Like, oh, I'm able to deconstruct some of this BS and see that, oh God, God does love me and I'm okay the way I am. Like, how was your road out? What was your exodus?
For me, it started in grad school. One of my office mates, she started talking to me one day about, I don't even know what we're talking about actually. But it came up that I said to her, well, I went through, conversion therapy. And she was like, you went through what? And at Liberty, they didn't call it conversion therapy, though I knew what it was. And I said to her, I told her this, and that was the first moment that kind of jolted me a little bit out of this mindset that was normal. Because at the time, I thoroughly believed it was normal. It was something that was, like you said before, clothed in secrecy. It was clothed in shame, all this kind of stuff. But I didn't think it was abnormal. I thought that what I was doing was the right thing. And this is the normal thing for Christians who are struggling, quote unquote, with same-sex attraction. And I thought that, that it wasn't that far-fetched or crazy for me to do. Again, I just didn't want to talk about it with most people. But at this point, I was beginning to become a little bit more public with my sexuality. And that was the first moment that kind of, again, shook me out of it. I decided I wanted to go to Vanderbilt because I wanted to study theological studies. And so I wanted to have that marriage of both a confessional aspect within my studies as well as a really strong academic focus. And once I got there, it was more so of an academic focus, just because I didn't want to do as much of the confessional stuff anymore. I wasn't giving as many hoots. So I had decided that I was going to go to do my PhD after that as well. So I was a little more academic. But the last course I took there, I did an analysis of conversion therapy. It was an ethics course, and I was talking about like the ethics of coming out and how for those of us who went through conversion therapy and for those of us who are, gay Christians at the time, identified as a gay Christian, the ethics of how, of coming out, why we should and or ought to be coming out and not just remaining within the closet and whatever. And so that was the first real academic approach to this topic. Then once I got to FAU, I started reading a lot of the work. I took a class on Elie Wiesel. My supervisor is one of the main scholars of Elie Wiesel. Elie Wiesel is a Nobel Prize winner. He wrote the book Night. It's this, I think the New York Times calls it, what do they call it? A slim volume of terrifying power. It's actually right here. I just so happen to have it here. But Elie Wiesel in his writings, not just in Night, but he certainly, this is true for the text, but in his other works as well, he has this unrelenting insistence that God should be held accountable, that God should offer some sort of response, bare minimum, a response, that it's incumbent upon God to respond. And he even wrote this New York Times, I believe it was a New York Times article, where he says, essentially, he's like, he's a concentration camp survivor. He went into the camps when he was young. He lost his entire family. His dad was with him in the camps until later on. And then his dad died, but his other family members were all murdered before that. And so he comes out, he waits 10 years, he writes this text. And then from there, he becomes a prolific author, he becomes known. But he has this article eventually where he says, it's like this open letter to God. And he says, like, God, can we just settle this? Like, can we just figure it the heck out? Like, what the hell was that? What was going on? Where were you? Where have you been? Where are you? Like, can we just settle this? Can we talk? And of course, it's a monologue. Of course, God does not respond. But that sort of unrelenting insistence upon God responding, for me, really just, I don't know, it shook me up in a way that I could not think about God in the same way. I could not accept the God that I had been given for so long, particularly, of course, at Liberty and also the church that I went to in high school. That God, in a lot of ways, died. Not to say that I don't believe in God or I didn't believe in God after that, because I do, I did believe in God. Who that God is, I have no idea. Like, I have zero clue. But it was Wiesel's writing and also studying the Holocaust in general, because my main focus is the Holocaust. I focus on the transmission of trauma between survivors and their children and their grandchildren. But with that, and also my previous studies on, survivor literature and Nazi propaganda and whatnot, all of this pointed me in a direction that was very much different and divergent from my theology or my theological standing when I went into Liberty, while I was at Liberty, and again shortly, you know, after Liberty. I think for me, it's been studying and actually like exploring, you know, other opinions, not just constantly reinforcing the evangelical perspective, that pushed me to reject the faith that I had as a teenager, as a kid.
Now, what's interesting for you, because I've part of my career, I've worked in youth ministry and worked for nonprofits, and one of the things that always broke my heart over time was being able to see how parents responded to kids coming out, and a lot of the times to where the parents would just utterly reject children, and you know, I know that there's, you know, what is LGBTQ youth, they have 2 times higher chance of being able to be suicidal than kids who are not. And your story is kind of backwards. Like, it's interesting, like, thinking about this, like, for someone that would go to Liberty, like, I've been around so many people's stories trying to come out with their evangelical parents. Yours is in the reverse. I'm curious, how did your parents, like, go through this? Because, again, I mean, one, about you coming out, but also them knowing that you went through conversion therapy with that, I mean, almost a thing that was trying to almost teach you to hate yourself. And you had parents that were agnostic, or one that, you know, that, and so I'm just curious, what were your parents' responses to a lot of this?
So too? I wish my dad would have eaten this up. My dad passed away when I was 16, but he was the kind of guy who would have been like, you're going to Jerry Falwell school. He would have not been okay with it. He wouldn't have been okay with any aspect of it. And he would have loved when I eventually came out. My dad was just like this, like, hippity dippity, hilarious, social worker / he owned a record store, / he wrote a book on Bob Dylan, / like, the guy was just like, you know, in a music studio in our basement. He became a vegetarian when my sister, I think she was like born or just shortly thereafter. And my mom had just bought a big, like, I think she bought like half a pig, and she had all these little babies, you know, plus my dad. My dad's like, nah, I'm not eating meat anymore, I'm becoming a vegetarian. So she was like, what am I supposed to do with this? He's like, I don't know, you figure it out. And I now have his leather coats, because he kept his leather coats, but he never wore them. So I need to get those fixed. Anyway, putting that aside. So my dad would have been like A-okay. He would not have given a hoot, but he think he would have liked it. He would have liked the end result. He obviously wouldn't have liked what happened earlier. My mom, on the other hand, Cheryl, she's wild. I haven't spoken to Cheryl in like 2 years, because the moment I came out, which was 2 years before that, I got just this, like, she became very religious all of a sudden. Let's put it that way. And of course, the reason being is that religious rhetoric lends itself very well to exclusionary thinking, exclusionary practices, and exclusionary, just, you know, again, excluding people. And so she had this knee-jerk reaction to me coming out. And I won't even repeat the things that she said, but I do have record of them, because I screenshotted them and sent them to my brother, Quinn. And so I went through them. It was like a year ago or 2 years ago. I went like, scroll. My brother and I talk a lot. All my siblings and I talk a decent amount. But I had scrolled through and I found them. And honestly, they were like, they're vile. The things that my mom said, she was like talking about like what she imagined to be my sex life. I was like, you don't even know if I'm having sex. Like, leave me alone. Like, telling me I was Sodom and Gomorrah. She spelled both of them incorrectly. And I was like, Mom, like, know your audience. You know, just talking really, really, in a base, gross way, in a way that no mother should ever speak to her child. And the best part was, because I told her, because she was going to come down to Nashville where I was living at the time. I told her though, and she freaked out. She hung up and, you know, sent me all these awful text messages and left a lot of voicemails and whatnot. But she then outed me to my whole family, which in some sense, like, it's like, that should have been my job. I should have been able to do that. But in some ways it freed me up from having to do that. But the great part of it was that literally everyone, except for 2 homophobic cousins who I don't talk to them, and nor do I care to hear, you know, what they think. Other than them, everyone, and I mean everyone, like, was like, you're a nut and you're horrible. And they like completely rejected, like, they like, after that, a lot of my sister stopped talking to her, you know, a lot of other people stopped talking to her. My aunts and uncle, at this point, none of them talked to her. Not necessarily just because of this, obviously there's a whole lot of underlying mental health issues for Cheryl, but it was great, because it was completely backfired. She thought she was gonna get all the support and, like, you know, oh, poor Cheryl, because your son's gay, but everyone's like, no, grow up, and like, what's the issue? So ultimately, it turned out quite nicely for me in that sense, where My family, other than my mom, and again these like this one cousin who's married to a homophobe, really, really quite nice. I guess also my mom's cousins. I haven't talked to a lot of them since, nor do I really care to, because again, I know their opinions and I don't really care to hear them.
I think we've all got those homophobic cousins that we
they're adorable.
That if they are, but ever you get to the point where they're like, I'm not talking to you anymore, and you're like, oh, that's a gift. Thank you.
Merci.
You act like it's horrible. Yeah. Well, Lucas, when we're talking about this, it seems like that you have been through this and you've walked it out well. Do you have stories of friends or other people that have been through this that necessarily did not walk through this quite as well?
Yeah. I certainly do my best. I don't know to the degree to which I've, or like the efficacy of of how I've handled this. What I would say is that I certainly, to answer your question, I certainly have a number of friends who did not handle this well. I can think of a few friends in particular who went through conversion therapy with me, whether it had been the individual, program as well as the group program. Some of them I knew were in the individual program. Some of them I met in the group program, which I only went to once. Anyway, that's another story. But meeting these folks there and also knowing them from before and then seeing them in, you know, group, of course, that clued me into that these are other gay men who didn't want to be gay. I can think of 4 of them that come to my mind right off the bat, though I'm sure if I did a little bit more thinking, I could think of a few extra. Are not only married to women now, and again, these are all guys who are gay, but have children or have children on the way. And that to me is just like horrible. It's, I couldn't imagine being married to someone who I don't want to be married to. This is the problem, is that this is not uncommon. Even actually, I made a fake email to reach back out to my conversion therapist not too long ago when he was still working there at Liberty. And I asked him, I said, and I was pretending I was like a student athlete, and he was very interested in meeting with me because I was a student athlete. And I said to him, like, you know, like, can I become straight essentially? And he's like, yeah, I'm actually doing a wedding for one of my guys, one of the guys he's worked with. Who's a church planner up in Pennsylvania or whatever. And so these guys are not exceptional in the literal sense of the word, right? Like they are not exceptions. They are the rule for people in these spaces. Of course, for me, I got the heck out. And that of course clues me into the reality that these guys could have gotten out as well. I think there were some qualitative differences between us, like our upbringing. I wasn't raised in the way that they were. I didn't have that constant pressure from parents, even though I knew that it wasn't going to be okay to come out to my mom. I always knew that was never going to be it was never going to be good to come out to her. I did know that I had a real strong support network outside of her, and you know, even my siblings. I certainly knew, even though at the time I wasn't too close to them. Now we're like, you know, thick as thieves. But I think that was mostly because I was religious, and they were like, "Get out of here." I think that. For these guys, they have certain, again, circumstances or life experiences that pushed them even further into the closet and disallowed them from coming out in the way that I did. But at the end of the day, we are all agents, free agents. We all have the ability to make our own choices. And at the end of the day, this is the decision that they made. I wouldn't even say for right or for wrong. It's obviously for wrong. But those are examples of people who did not come out of this well. And I can think of, you know, there are two other guys that come to mind. One guy in Alaska who was just this unbelievably funny, wonderful human. And then this other guy who I know, he lives in Virginia, I believe. I knew both of them when I was at Liberty. And both these guys, they're single and they've committed to lives of celibacy. And I'm not saying sex is everything, but it certainly is, you know, like your sexuality and your, and how that, you know, is lived, how you live that out. Is part of what makes people people, first of all, and also makes happy people. And the idea of these guys saying, no, I'm never going to, you know, be in a relationship with a man. It's heartbreaking. And it's like, my God, like, how are you still tied to this theology? How are you still believing that this is what God wants for you? But again, it is what they believe. And as a result, their lives are from what I can see. And when I have talked to them really, you know, brief moments when I've talked to them, their lives don't look good and they don't sound good. And again, I'm not saying that their sexuality is everything, and no one's sexuality is everything. It's not the totality of what makes a human human, but it is certainly a part of it. And I feel really, really bad for these folks.
Well, and especially when people are told, and I've known people that have gotten out, and I've known people that have kind of done this, what you're talking about, and kind of brainwash themselves and go back into this, but they end up being in a situation to where they're like, well, this whole part of me is just evil. You know, like, there's this whole part of me is just bad. Like, it, and to go and think that part of who you are, especially if for folks at Liberty that would assume that we are created in God's image, to assume that like a large part of you is just evil and bad and needs to be cut out like rot. Yeah, you're going to live your life as a partial person. You're going to live your life just partially in these ways. And you're right. It's not, sex isn't everything, but the idea of learning how to be able to love yourself and that you are created well is a very different way to live than learning to hate yourself, which I think that those that get raised in the church learn to hate themselves a lot.
Well, you
more.
Know what? And I think that's part of conversion therapy. And again, part of the church's theology of sexuality, right? So I think that oftentimes what happens is that in the beginning we're taught, you know, it's not that you, well, they, we, first of all, we are taught that we're like horrible, like we're horrible beings in so many ways, which, you know, really does well for someone's self-esteem. But then what will happen is oftentimes it'll be like, okay, so there'll be the separation because you're a new creation in Christ. So it's a separation of you as that new creation in Christ and your actions. Mm. And so they'll say, you know, your actions, like every, you know, let's say someone looks at porn and they feel bad about it. Oh, that's, they feel guilty, right? So they kind of a slap on the wrist, like, okay, I'm going to do better next time. Then the next thing happens and they look at porn because, well, they're, you know, 18-year-old kids. And then they slap on the wrist, guilty, feel bad. And there's a sense of guilt, which is like this, like one moment in time, sort of feeling, or this, like sensation or intensity of energy where you feel guilty. It's for that one transgression, that one action. What happens is over time is that as those folks realize, again, for looking at porn or finding men attractive, that it's not just this one off transgression. It's the one off, you know, bad action. They start realizing this is a pattern and it keeps happening, keeps happening, it keeps happening. Then that person says, well, the problem isn't so much the, you know, how do you say, like, it's not just these one-off moments. Really, it's, this is really who I am, right? It's that it's not, and that turns into, the guilt turns into shame, where it's like, shame says that you as a person are bad. Mm. And that's, again, people think for a long time, like, I'm trying, but when that effort to change never manifests in actual change, that person's going to turn on themselves and say, like, I'm the problem, I'm bad, I'm disgusting. And that's when you get these really horrible self-perceptions that turn into some really death-dealing consequences, and which is one of which, of course, is not uncommon in the church, and specifically for LGBTQ youth within religious spaces, and that's suicidal ideation.
Yeah, no, that's very true. Now, for I Lucas, I appreciate you being so open and being able to share your story in this way today. What to kind of give us an idea? What is next for this class action suit? You know, like where are we at in the realm of all this?
Yeah, so we're pushing forward. I believe the U.S. Department of Education has the chance to, they're trying to dismiss the case, of course, which is just sort of standard protocol in these cases, because, of course, the U.S. Department of Education has to defend itself. Like, that's, they have lawyers there for that reason, even though I feel, and I think a lot of the people who are watching this case know that they don't think it's okay the way that these schools treat their student, or treats, their queer students. But there's going to be that ability for the motion to be struck down, which I believe is happening. Let me just double check my calendar. I think it's like, if not next week, the week after, soon thereafter. And so we're hoping that it's not struck down. We're hoping that we're successful. If we're not successful, then we go to the Court of Appeals. And then, you know, we keep putting this or pushing this case up, and it'll probably go to the Supreme Court. It's kind of what we're expecting. But next up is, again, I believe it's the Department of Education's move. From there, how we will respond accordingly, and either go through with the case at this level, or we'll appeal and go further up in the circuit.
Well, Lucas, if people want to follow you and what you're up to, or this case in particular, what is a good way for them to be able to connect or follow you or keep up with what's happening?
Yeah. So my Instagram is at Luke Slam Dunk Wilson. And my Twitter, I always forget, so I always have to look it up. Here we are. It is at Wilson underscore F as in Frederick W. So both of those, and also Facebook, but those Instagram and Twitter are where I'm most active.
Well, I appreciate your time here and you being able to share your story fully. And I'm also excited to see, with fingers crossed, hoping that this thing moves forward in a way that we can find meaningful change in our systems, especially. Yeah. So let's.
I certainly hope so. I hope that liberty is put in its place and it begins to treat students well and like humans.
It'd also be biblical, nice. But that may be a bridge too far for them, but you know, liberty. All right. Well, Lucas Wilson, thank you so much for being on the show today. I really appreciate you and appreciate your time.
Stuart, I appreciate you. I appreciate your time and thank you for having me.
Well, much thanks to Lucas for being a part of this show for this last hour. And guess what? That's it. That's all we got today, guys. I'm serious. I know. But I promise this. Next week, we're back on schedule of going through the Sermon on the Mount. And as I do every week, I send you out with the holiest amount of grace and peace and snark. Go out into this world and live as though you are blessed because you are. So go bless someone else. Go make a difference in someone's life because I know you can do it. That's all I got this week. I'm out of here. Peace.